You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin has been seeing more flooding, and it turns out wetlands may have a role in lessening the impact of heavy rains. Our guest tells us that preserving and restoring wetlands can have a big payoff. First, the University of Wisconsin system is voting on a new policy that will suspend or expel students who repeatedly disrupt free speech events on campus. According to the UW system, the goal of this policy is ultimately to protect the free speech rights of students and speakers. The move has been criticized by people on the right and the left. Just this week, conservative groups like the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and the Charles Koch Foundation said the move could have the opposite of its intended effect. And Democratic Governor Tony Evers has indicated that he'll challenge the move. Rich Kramer is a reporter for WPR based in Eau Claire. He's been following this story. Rich, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, Rich, give us some background here. Why is the UW System Board of Regents pursuing this policy change?
So, I mean, this goes back to 2015, actually. The UW Board of Regents then put out a policy kind of reaffirming its support of academic freedom and free speech on campus. But in 2017, the state legislature, and particularly Assembly Republicans, introduced legislation that would require the university to not only reaffirm its commitment to free speech, but it also required punishments in this bill. The bill would direct the university to include language in its rules that would suspend students who disrupt free speech on two occasions and require expulsion after three occasions. So I looked into that a little bit, and that bill was modeled off of a model legislation from the conservative Goldwater Institute, and the bill ultimately died. But right after, in 2017, the UW Board of Regents announced that they were going to include similar language, I mean almost identical language, in their administrative rules. But that process of putting together administrative rules takes a long time, so that's why we've had multiple votes on this same topic.
And the concern is usually over the idea that liberal college students might be disrupting events and speeches featuring conservative speakers. That's why we see Republicans advancing this in the Assembly, why the Goldwater Institute might be on top of this issue. Is that right?
That is right. Yeah, it really, you know, one of the main situations that is referred to by supporters of this legislation and this proposed rule for the UW system is they look to Berkeley. So back in 2016, there was a conservative speaker that was going to give a speech there, and there was violent protests. I mean, it was a riot that forced the university to cancel that. So that raised a lot of alarm among conservative groups that say that universities are not welcoming to their ideas, and that these places and students on campus generally are of a liberal kind of bent, and they just refuse to hear and they shout down. So in Wisconsin, there were a couple of examples, not nearly to the level of what happened in Berkeley, but conservative speaker Ben Shapiro was going to speak at UW-Madison. Some students came in and basically disrupted the event for a little while. And then there was another conservative speaker that was going to UW-Milwaukee, and a similar incident happened where students came in and tried to speak over him. But in both of those cases, the speakers were allowed to finish after the students were escorted out.
And you mentioned this is a process for the UW Regents to pass this policy. Where exactly is it? It's a multi-stage event, it seems like.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they've already voted to affirm the policy. So the policy, if you read it, it would appear that these punishments are already in effect. But in order for the UW to actually act on and expel students or suspend students, they have to go through the administrative rules process, which takes a long time. They've already held a preliminary public hearing on it at the last Regents meeting. They voted to move to the next step on what's called a scope statement. Basically, it's giving the UW system the ability to actually write the language that would go into the state administrative code. So that has to be there's another public hearing coming, and then ultimately they'll vote to pass that on to Governor Evers, and the governor has said that he isn't in support.
talking to WPR reporter Rich Kramer about a UW Regents policy, a free speech policy that could punish students who disrupt speaking events. I want to listen to a couple of voices that you've shared with us, Rich. First of all, Board of Regents President Drew Peterson, who voted in favor. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
To adhere to the state's procedural requirements, as president of this board, I'll be supporting this item.
So that doesn't sound like a real ringing endorsement, but did we hear stronger statements from members of the Board of Regents on this issue?
Not really. There was not much discussion at all. The only discussion about the proposed punishments came from Regent Edward Benedides, who was appointed by Governor Evers, and he basically said that he's not in support of this. He can't support it. He was one of three members to vote against it, but it was a voice vote, so the motion carried. And the concerns among regents is that, you know, the punishments are not necessary, and in general the concerns about it have been that the scope of them are kind of broad, like they're not specifically defining what is not allowed, and there's thoughts that could cause legal questions about, you know, the free speech rights.
And Rich, you mentioned Governor Evers not supporting this. Here's his spokesperson, Melis Baldoff, talking about the proposal.
The governor voted against this policy when he was a member of the Board of Regents, and his position on it hasn't changed. He still does not support this policy.
Rich, can the governor do anything to stop this policy if he opposes it?
Yeah, I mean, the proposed rulemaking process basically stops if the governor doesn't offer his signature, his endorsement of the proposed rule that's being that's in the works right now. So I did talk to Regent President Drew Peterson about that. What if the governor, because when I interviewed him, the governor hadn't made that statement yet. And I said, well, what happens if the governor doesn't allow it? Well, that kind of stops the UW process. And he said that it would be likely that lawmakers would kind of reintroduce the bill. And the bill has been reintroduced, actually, in August of this year. But ultimately, what I've also heard from State Senator Chris Kapinga is that, you know, even the bill has to be approved by the governor. Ultimately, he can veto it if he wants. So it's unclear what happens if this ever goes into effect, at least during Governor Evers' administration.
And then bringing this full circle, you mentioned this initiative nationwide is supported by these kind of requirements are supported by a conservative group. Republican Assembly representatives had advanced it. But now we see groups like the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and the Koch Institute, both seen as conservative groups, mm-hmm. opposing it. Here's Koch Institute Senior Fellow Casey Maddox talking about the issue.
Wisconsin has been one of the few places where, largely probably driven by the approaches from state legislators, they actually ended up adopting a policy like this that would, in my view, have actually squelched student speech in an effort to try to protect it.
So can you talk, Rich, more about the arguments from conservative groups in Wisconsin
Sure.
against the way the state is tackling this?
Yeah, and to be clear, conservative groups do think it's important to reaffirm that all voices are heard on campus. Mm-hmm. I mean, They're not against that, but the issue seems to be these mandatory minimum punishments. And what Casey Maddox of the Koch Institute was telling me, that was in response to me asking about this Goldwater model legislation that has been taken up by other states. You know, Arizona, Georgia, a whole slew of states have included the similar language from that model legislation into their university system rules, but Wisconsin is one of the only states, I think Arizona might be the other one, that mandate punishments. And Wisconsin's mandatory suspension and expulsion seem to be the strongest.
Rich, what have we heard from student groups about this policy?
Though they're not in favor of it. I mean, I was covering in 2016, I was at the University of Wisconsin Stout in Menominee when the Regents first introduced this mandatory punishment language, and they said that it's literally going to do the opposite of what regents are hoping. There's thoughts of worries about a chilling effect, like if there's the potential for being expelled, students might not use their free speech rights to protest speakers. There's just concerns that because of the way it's written, it could be interpreted differently on different campuses because of the broadness of it.
As we wrap up, Rich, what are you watching for next?
Well, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I guess the governor's, if he kills the UW attempt to enact these this legislation, then, you know, I think you can expect to see the state assembly, Republicans at least, and maybe the state Senate too, this legislation will get more attention. And ultimately, that does rest with the governor. But if I mean, there could be a veto override. I don't know if that would be likely, but there's going to be a lot of kicks at the cat, as they say, in the future.
Rich, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Rich Kramer is a reporter for WPR based in Eau Claire. He joined us today to talk about some conservative groups coming out to oppose the UW system's proposed policy changes, which would allow schools to punish students who interrupt speakers on campus. Coming up, a pilot project in Ashland County may eventually provide a roadmap for how wetlands can help local governments deal with flooding after severe storms. We'll get the details coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we recap last night's Democratic presidential candidate debate as part of our roundup of this week's top stories in national politics. First, the Midwest is likely to see more and more rain, according to scientists who study climate change, and that means flooding will be a bigger problem, too. Our next guest says there's a natural strategy to help deal with flooding we should be talking more about, and that's wetlands. Kyle McGarrah is a local government outreach specialist for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. He was quoted in a recent article from WisContext titled, "When Big Storms Inundate Wisconsin, How Could Wetlands Slow the Flow?" Kyle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Appreciate the interest in the topic.
Well, let's talk about that phrase I just used, slow the flow. How can wetlands help slow down the progress of rain into waterways and maybe ultimately slow down flooding?
Yeah, great question. So slow the flow is a term that's originated in a lot of the regional efforts up in the Lake Superior Basin to think about the different strategies for how to reduce the velocity of water. And wetlands certainly fit into that equation. So there, you know, healthy wetland landscapes, you know, from the headwaters all the way down through their floodplains, are really intricate parts of our water management system. So in the upper reaches, really retaining and storing that water, slowing the flow of water by reducing the stream power, the energy of that runoff that's moving through our watersheds, increasing soil infiltration and really intercepting the water as it drops from the sky and works its way through the different portions of a watershed. So really it's about getting water back into groundwater and helping to slowly release it in manageable ways before it becomes hazardous.
How much wetland area have we lost in Wisconsin over the last 100, 150 years or so?
The general figure statewide is about 50%. It varies regionally in southern Wisconsin, where we've had more urban and agricultural pressure. We've certainly lost much higher than that. You know, some figures quote up to 80-90%. And in northern Wisconsin, outright wetland loss has been less, but when you look at the maps and the different information that we have that helps us to understand where wetlands are or were on the landscape, they don't really accurately capture the condition of those wetlands that and how they perform different services like flood attenuation. So even though we've lost a significant amount, much of the wetlands that remain are degraded and have a limited ability to slow the flow and provide some of the flood storage that's really critical in these rain events.
I mentioned that WisContext piece. It focuses on Ashland County. Can you tell us about a pilot project they're working on in Ashland County?
Yes. So we, after the July 2016 storm that hit northwestern Wisconsin, we have a longstanding collaboration with the Wisconsin Coastal Management Program. And through that, we set out to really examine what the data tells us, what are the on-the-ground conditions, and really what are the strategies that local communities can utilize to start to build resilience by rebuilding their natural infrastructure. And the report exploring the relationship between wetlands and flood hazards in the Lake Superior Basin documents a lot of our findings, but What that led is that there was a lot of hot spots in the region where there is a density of road failures or culvert washouts, and there was certainly a need to take a look, a place-based look at on-the-ground conditions, and Ashland County was one of the hardest-hit areas. And so in using that initial examination, we were able to connect with community leaders, the emergency manager, the county conservationist, the highway commissioner, many other natural resources managers in that region to start, what do we do next? What types of data are needed? What types of research? And really, what types of on-the-ground projects are needed to help demonstrate the ways that wetlands can be solutions?
Now, I know I hear a lot about landowners doing prairie preservation or restoration on their property. Do we have a similar kind of thing going on with wetlands in the state?
Yes, there's a long history of restoring wetlands, mostly driven by the need to recover waterfall populations and other habitat. So that a lot of our programs, such as through the Farm Bill, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, and many others, are really geared towards restoring wetlands to put wetlands back on the landscape so they provide those habitat functions. So there are many, there's a lot of investment going on there, but those programs, the ways that you would restore wetlands for habitat purposes usually means retiring farmland and putting up a virtual fence to stay out of the wetland area. But if we're talking about managing wetlands for flood mitigation purposes, you need to find creative ways to allow farmers to use like managed grazing and haying and agroforestry, empower them with the right expertise so they can manage waters really in voluntary small-scale ways that rebuilds the hydrology and those degraded water conditions, arresting them so that we can regain some of the services that wetlands once provided. So it's really part of the pilot project in Ashland County is about expanding the toolbox to understand different techniques that can be used.
Talking to Kyle McGarra from the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, looking at wetlands in Wisconsin and the role they can play in limiting at least the damage of floods from fast-moving storms. Kyle, another part of the story here is that not everything we talk about as wetlands looks like a wetland always. Like we think maybe of a swamp or a marshy area. I understand there are some intermittent wetlands that can step up and absorb a lot of water, but don't look like wetlands year-round.
Correct. Wisconsin is blessed with, it's a very water-rich state, and the appearance of wetlands really varies by season or time of year and how they interact with these different storm events. So wetlands are very critical during spring runoff and snowmelt, so you might have very small basins, ephemeral ponds, very small depressions that will hold water when we have a lot of water on the landscape. But over as summer progresses, as we get into fall and winter, those wetlands will dry up. They'll draw down. There's those dynamics, and they will look very different at different times of the year. So typically, most people are thinking about our deep open water marshes that line the edges of lakes, rivers, and streams. But wetlands can be very wooded, they can wet meadows, and like the ephemeral pond example, they can dry out. Those ephemeral wetlands, though, are really critical when we're receiving these rain events because as they draw down, there's additional storage available. They're helping to manage, slowly release that water downstream. So it's looking at, you're not necessarily going to restore one large wetland complex. It's looking at the ways and collectively, in aggregate, those different types of wetlands can perform.
When we think of federal or state emergency spending when it comes to floods, we might think of things like dams and levees and drainage systems, things like that. Do emergency managers at this point help develop and maybe even fund wetlands as part of their flooding strategies?
Traditionally, nature-based solutions have not been fully integrated into our hazard mitigation or our flood preparedness activities. There's certainly a lot of communities out there that are beginning to look at their natural infrastructure, but historically the urge was how can we convey as much water as quickly off the landscape as possible? So having levees to keep the water out to channelize areas to reroute it away from our infrastructure and our other economic assets. But as we've seen these new storms become more common, there's certainly growing interest across the state from many community leaders to look at how can we rebuild those hydrologic processes so we can manage the water in ways so that they're more self-sustaining and they can recover some of the natural processes that historically may have once existed.
Is there anything going on at the level of the state legislature when it comes to wetlands and flood control?
Yes, there is a current, in parallel to the pilot project in Ashland County, so there is a provisionally approved to perform a watershed assessment in the Marengo River watershed through a FEMA pre-disaster mitigation proposal. And really the spirit of that is to help identify areas on the landscape that can be restored for flood storage and mitigation purposes. In parallel to that, there is an initiative to fund some demonstration projects. The AB 266 and SB 252, thanks to the leadership from Representative Steinicke, Senator Prochowski, Representative Myers, and Senator Bewley, to introduce that. And really what the intent of that is, there's a lot of techniques that are being used, like out in the Pacific Northwest and the Western states, to look at the various small-scale ways of how can you naturally mimic the conditions, using boulders, woody debris, things that will help to reconnect and revitalize floodplains. So the purpose of that particular bill would provide some funding to Ashland County to look at ways to set up a scheme and then combination of practices that can rebuild those natural processes using different techniques. So showcase them and understand in what situations they can be most effective and provide some recommendations or guidelines for how to scale those up to provide some meaningful reductions in peak flow.
Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Kyle Magara, a local government outreach specialist for Wisconsin Wetlands Association. He was with us today to talk about how state wetlands can help slow the flow of flooding. If you want to learn more, you can find an article Kyle was quoted in at wiscontext.org. Coming up, a look at some of the top stories in national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at how Wisconsin's U.S. House members are talking about the impeachment inquiry and how different political dynamics in their home districts may influence their decisions. First, it's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. We had a packed Democratic presidential debate last night. There's an ongoing impeachment inquiry gathering steam and testimony while the White House refuses to cooperate. And two top U.S. officials are heading to Turkey in an attempt to halt military action against U.S. allied Kurds in northern Syria. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the debate last night? Did any candidates stand out to you in a new way? Was there a topic you are glad you heard come up? Is there something you wish had come up but did not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you watching or listening to the debates, or are you just going to wait it out since you can't vote for a while? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amanda Turkle is with us, Washington Bureau Chief at HuffPost. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, great to be here.
Well, let's start with last night's debate, the latest among Democratic candidates. First one since Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced the opening of this impeachment inquiry. Did that come up at the debate at all, that whole impeachment thing?
It did. It was the first question asked, and that was actually pretty good for the Democratic candidates. So far in the other debates, we've seen a lot of division right off, arguing about things like Medicare for All and immigration. This time, the question of impeachment came up. And it was stark because it shows how far the party has come. Everyone was in agreement that it's right for the House to be looking into an impeachment inquiry and looking at whether it's right to impeach the president. And you just didn't have a lot of disagreement. The most interesting thing to me was that Elizabeth Warren said that it was a subtle rebuke of Nancy Pelosi and House Democrats. She said, you know, we waited to do impeachment and look at what the president did in the meantime. He continued to break laws, you know, sort of you should have listened to me and done it earlier and it would have been better off. But for the most part, it was, you know, it was a show of unity amongst the candidates.
A dynamic coming into this debate was that Senator Warren has been catching up with former Vice President Joe Biden in the polls, pretty much neck and neck at this point. How did that play out at the debate?
Warren was definitely the target, which really showed that she is now the front runner or one of the front runners in a way that she hasn't been during the past debates. Warren has been in this interesting position where she's sort of been in the top three, but Bernie's been seen to be above her. So Bernie Sanders was taking a lot of the sort of fire, having to defend like progressive and liberal positions. Biden was obviously getting attacks. And Warren was sort of skating by. But last night, she was definitely into the target. She was having to defend quite a bit. And it just, again, showed that she is now, she's increasingly hot.
And then there were candidates in the middle who were trying to stake out a more moderate position than Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. Who stood out in the field at the debate last night?
Both Amy Klobuchar, who has struggled to sort of get ahead of the field, and Pete Buttigieg, who has been raising tons and tons of money, but also has been sort of stuck in the middle. They both made a strong bid for the centrist lane, maybe people who want an alternative to Joe Biden. And you saw Buttigieg be particularly aggressive in calling out some of his more liberal colleagues, pressing them to be more specific on their plans, you know, just saying that they were unrealistic. And that was, you know, I think we're getting to the point in the race where candidates, it's getting harder and harder to qualify for the debates. I think there are a lot of Democrats who would like to see the field narrowed down a bit more. And so candidates are really now having to figure out a way to distinguish themselves to stay in the race.
Right. This was the merged debate. We'd seen at least some of the debates so far, splitting the stage. Now all remaining qualifying candidates, it appears, will be on the stage together. That made for a really big debate. Was it hard to learn much about candidates, given that there were a bunch of them up there?
Well, it was 3 hours, so we had a lot of time to learn about them. But sure, there were candidates who got a bit lost. You know, Kamala Harris is someone who really distinguished herself in the first debate when she took on Joe Biden. Last night, she really didn't have much of a presence. Tom Steyer, the billionaire who entered the field pretty late, is basically, you know, putting tons and tons of his own money into the campaign. This was his first debate. He popped up here and there, but was largely not a presence. So certainly there are some people who dominated more than others. And when you have 12 people, it's hard for everyone to have, you know, equal time, obviously.
Talking to Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief at HuffPost, looking at some of the big stories in national politics. Amanda, news is coming out just today about fundraising for candidates. That can be a little wonky, insider politics-y, but is there anything you're watching in as numbers come out from time to time?
The big thing is, you know, you've had the presidential candidates release a lot of money about how much they've raised, and they often spin those numbers in ways that make it that seem like they've all raised tons and tons of money from small donors in every single state. But a lot of what was released yesterday were more granular details, including how much money they actually have in the bank. And what really stood out was that Joe Biden has far less in the bank than the other top tier candidates. He's raised a lot of money, but he's also spent a lot of money. And so right now he has about $9 million in the bank. So in other words, for every $1 that he's raised, he spent about $1.12. That is not great. Bernie Sanders has more than $33 million in the bank. Warren has more than $25 million. Pete Buttigieg has more than $23 million. You know, even Kamala Harris has more than $10 million. So that rate of spending is not really great for someone who's supposed to be the front runner. And I think it has some donors a little bit concerned about whether that's sustainable.
Well, as you mentioned, this debate comes in the midst of this impeachment inquiry. It was a big question at the debate. We're seeing a lot of testimony over the last few days. This week we had Fiona Hill, who was the president's former top advisor on Russia, George Kent, deputy assistant secretary in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs. More to come and more people. And the ousted ambassador to Ukraine herself testified last week. A lot of people showing up to testify when it wasn't clear that they necessarily would. What are we learning so far?
Basically, it has been hard, I think, for a lot of people who aren't in Washington and following this day to day to keep up with who's testifying and how they're testifying. But the basis is, you know, the basic facts are that the testimony these people are providing are just proving what the whistleblower said. The whistleblower account has been backed up by all of these people coming in, that Rudy Giuliani played an outsized role, considering he is not a government official. You had a former White House advisor say that he was basically running a shadow foreign policy operation devoted solely to helping the president personally. You have this picture emerge of the fact that the operations of the government and U.S. foreign policy weren't operating in the neutral way that they're supposed to. And that really troubled a lot of career Foreign Service officials, including some who were either pushed out or resigned over it. And, you know, basically foreign policy, which is not supposed to be political, was made incredibly political to personally benefit the president.
And the White House has said it will not, on the whole, comply with subpoenas from the impeachment inquiry. The vice president has said the same. What's been the response to that?
Yeah, they've said they're not going to comply, but they also said they didn't want any administration officials or former administration officials to go before Congress and testify. And officials have said, you know, too bad. If I am subpoenaed, I'm going to go and testify because I don't want to be breaking the law. I'd rather make Donald Trump mad than break the law and, you know, face some sort of penalty. You know, the Trump administration wants that Nancy Pelosi to hold a vote to open a formal impeachment inquiry. And some impeachment inquiries in the past have started that way. But there's nothing in the Constitution that says Nancy Pelosi has to do that. You know, she has said we are in impeachment mode. You know, some courts seem to find that sufficient. And so, you know, the Trump administration wants to do this to show that it's partisan, to just sort of divide Democrats a little bit more, confuse the public, the state of the impeachment inquiry. But so far, it seems that Democrats aren't going to do that. They're going to stay focused. And it shows that they don't really have to, because they are getting the testimony so far that they need from a lot of officials.
There's been video going around of Senator Lindsey Graham, then a member of the House during the Clinton impeachment, saying that not complying with subpoenas was an impeachable offense in and of itself. He was referring there to the Nixon impeachment. He was recently asked if he's changed his stance on that. Here's a listen.
What can you tell us about what your view is at this point of Democrats' impeachment probe? 20 years ago, you said that not complying with the subpoena was an impeachable offense.
Nothing's changed.
So he says nothing's changed, meaning apparently that not complying with subpoena was an impeachable offense. He's been in many ways a supporter of President Trump, though not on Syria, which we'll get to in just a few minutes. What do you make of the latest of what you're hearing from Senator Graham and others in the Senate?
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting comment, too. I mean, like you said, there have been some breaks between Lindsey Graham and the Trump White House in Syria. But for the most part, it seems like Graham is standing by him, although, you know, I think that what Graham said shows that there is frustration amongst Republicans privately, maybe more so than publicly, that they know that what Trump did doesn't look great. Not only, you know, what he was doing with the president of Ukraine, but also the system of how they were hiding the transcripts of Trump's calls that were politically sensitive in ways that you're not supposed to do it. That has made a lot of Republicans uncomfortable. They don't really want to be defending it. And so they need to make a calculation on whether they defend Trump or whether they break with him and suffer consequences, perhaps politically. But underneath the surface, there's a lot more, I think, uneasiness than you hear publicly.
Talking to HuffPost Washington Bureau Chief Amanda Turkle about some of the top news in Washington this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the impeachment inquiry is going? What do you want to see turned to next? And we'll turn to the latest in Turkey and northern Syria. A vote in the House today on that issue. Call 800-642-1234. Let us know what you think of that. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with HuffPost Washington Bureau Chief Amanda Turkle, looking at some of the big stories in national politics. Before we go to the latest on congressional reaction on Turkey and Syria and the Kurds, Amanda, Hunter Biden, son of 2020 candidate and former Vice President Joe Biden, recently talked to ABC, said his roles at a Chinese company and Ukrainian company weren't, he said, illegal, but showed poor judgment and probably had to do something to do with his last name being Biden. You reported on that and some of the reactions from others on the Hunter Biden story. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think that some Democrats are in a sort of a funny position. They know that Trump's claims about Hunter Biden and Joe Biden are completely baseless. They're nothing more than conspiracy theories. But there is the fact that Hunter Biden did cash in on the family name to get positions in China and Ukrainian companies, you know, on boards that he really wasn't qualified for beyond his name, probably. And he's admitted that. And, you know, I think that sort of cronyism and nepotism makes a lot of Democrats and Republicans uncomfortable. But it's not exclusive to the Bidens. And even if it's not illegal, it's unethical and maybe a little shady. But I found it interesting that and sort of how disingenuous a lot of the political attacks are. The people who have been criticizing the Bidens for this have been people like the Republican National Committee Chairwoman Rona Romney McDaniel, who's obviously the niece of Mitt Romney, whose grandfather was governor of Michigan. Her grandmother and mother ran for Senate. Her father ran for Attorney General of Michigan. You know, Rand Paul, senator, whose father was Congressman Ron Paul. You know, just people. And then, you know, Donald Trump Jr., who's obviously sort of a product of nepotism. So it's been funny that the lack of awareness by some of these people criticizing the Bidens, and just also shows how pervasive this system is in Washington, in a way that, you know, you can sort of understand why a lot of people around the country find it a little bit disgusting.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hi. I don't find any of the accusations funny or to be dismissed, whether they are Republicans or Democrats. This is what's going on. This is the kind of thing where people leave government with millions of dollars after having salaries of $150,000. Not funny as far as I'm concerned. And I think you should be more serious about the accusations, not only against Joe Biden's son, but any of these politicians.
Tom, thanks for the call. And Tom, raising concerns about corruption, or at least the appearance of corruption, Amanda.
Right. I mean, in my comments also weren't that this sort of cronyism is funny, by the way. But, you know, I think a lot of people find this cronyism and nepotism that's pervasive in politics and business disgusting. And I think that there are, you know, candidates in the Democratic field, especially, who have put forward plans who, you know, to try to outlaw these sorts of positions and this sort of profiting from public service. And, you know, when people say that they're frustrated with Washington, that people are crooks, you know, this sort of thing is what, you know, is what people are often talking about. You know, Trump got a lot of attention and I think a lot of support for saying that he wanted to drain the swamp. And I think that message resonated with people. Obviously, Trump has not done that. He has put lobbyists in his administration. You know, he is now embroiled in the scandal where it seems like he is using government service to enrich himself and his friends. But, you know, that sort of message, I think people like.
Talking to Amanda Turkle from HuffPost about some of the top stories in national politics. Thanks, Tom, for the call. Big story in Washington, the president pulling troops out of northern Syria, apparently giving the green light, people are saying, to the government of Turkey for a military incursion into the area. We have Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo headed over to talk to President Erdogan of Turkey, trying to negotiate a ceasefire. A lot of criticism from Democrats and Republicans of the president's moves. Here's a little listen to President Trump defending his moves today, talking at a press conference with the president of Italy.
Our soldiers are not in harm's way, as they shouldn't be, as two countries fight over land. That has nothing to do with us. And the Kurds are much safer right now, but the Kurds know how to fight. And as I said, they're not angels. They're not angels. If you take a look, you have to go back and take a look. But they fought with us. We paid a lot of money for them to fight with us, and that's okay.
So the president talking more about the Kurds. Meanwhile, the House voted a pretty big bipartisan vote to condemn the moves here in the invasion. Amanda, what do you make of all of this?
It's pretty remarkable at a time when there's not a lot of bipartisanship in Washington that you could have 354 members of the House, Democrats and many Republicans, rebuke Trump on foreign policy. And those included people like House leadership, Steve Scalise, Kevin McCarthy, Liz Cheney. And then you had 60 Republicans who voted to stand by Trump. And these were people in very, very conservative districts. But, you know, Trump's decision of what he decided to do in Syria, I think, just took a lot of people by surprise, including in his own White House. He just seemed, you know, he discarded the advice of a lot of his advisors and just said he was going to go with his gut and didn't fully think through the consequences and how badly it could go so quickly.
And Lindsey Graham, again, Senator Lindsey Graham, often a Trump supporter. He, in a hearing in the Senate with a State Department appointee, said, I think this is the most screwed up decision I've seen in my whole time in Congress. And he wrote, he tweeted a lot today, I worry we will not have allies in the future against radical Islam. ISIS will reemerge and Iran's rise in Syria will become a nightmare for Israel. He went on, I fear this is a complete and utter national security disaster in the making. And I hope President Trump will adjust his thinking. Pretty strong criticism from a usual supporter of the president.
Right. I mean, I think a lot of people are concerned that we, you know, the Kurds have been assisting U.S. forces and expect some sort of protection and guarantee of assistance in return. And Trump seemed to have just all of a sudden, without warning, pulled out the rug from that agreement and broken that agreement. And I think it will make, you know, the concern is that it'll make some other potential allies leery about partnering with the United States because, you know, what will happen? Will they abandon them and leave them, you know, to their adversaries in the future as well?
I want to bring on one caller going back to the debates where we started. Amanda, we've got Gary with us in Mozanie. Gary, hi.
Hello. I'm wondering how they set the time for the candidates to answer the question.
Yeah,
seems
Gary.
Like they were being, seems like they were being cut off just about every time they spoke, except for Yang and Steyer and Gabbard, you know, and Cory Booker. They could have went out for lunch before they were even called on.
Gary, thanks for the call. There have been a lot of bar graphs showing who got to talk how much, Amanda.
Yeah, I honestly don't know the formal rules of how they decide, but it is, you know, the candidates, it's not a coincidence that the front runner candidates get to go first. They stand in the center of the stage. They get to go first. They usually get more time as well. Candidates get a certain amount of time when a question goes to them. And then if they're mentioned, they get a certain amount of time to respond. You know, I think the moderators try to do a fairly good, they try to give candidates what they deem to be a fair amount of time, but certainly there are candidates who don't get as much because of their lower tier status or because they don't jump in and interrupt as much or because the candidate, other candidates don't mention them and so they don't get to reply.
Gary, thanks for that call. In our last few moments, Amanda, we are basically dealing with multiple news fire hoses right now. Which one are you watching next?
I mean, the thing, honestly, I'm watching right now is that, you know, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leaders in Congress, just came from a meeting at the White House with Trump, where Trump apparently insulted Nancy Pelosi, calling her a third-rate politician to her face. Democrats are saying that it was basically a meltdown by Trump, and he was really shaken up by the Syria policy. So it'll be interesting to see how Trump lashes out at sort of what's going on in the coming days.
Amanda, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Been talking to Amanda Turkle from HuffPost in our weekly roundup of news in national politics, including last night's Democratic presidential candidate debate, the latest in the impeachment inquiry, and the situation in Turkey and Syria. As always, you can share your thoughts briefly, given the format on these issues. Go to Twitter and find us at Central Time WPR and let us know what you think. This year marks the 70th anniversary of an invention that revolutionized the world of sports, and this is a good time of the year to celebrate it. In 1949, that invention was patented by an entrepreneur and inventor by the name of Frank Zamboni. The Zamboni is a key piece of equipment for the hockey world, with the NHL and college hockey seasons in full swing, and figure skaters and speed skaters count on it too. If you've never seen one in action, the Zamboni is the machine that can put a smooth ice surface on a rink fast enough to get the job done between periods in a hockey game. It shaves the ice and squeegees a new icy surface as it goes. As reported on the Smithsonian website, the pre-Zamboni landscape, or icescape, was very different. Teams of workers used shovels, brooms, squeegees, and small handheld plows, and even then, the ice surface was not really very even. Enter Frank Zamboni. In 1939, he opens an ice rink in Southern California called Paramount Iceland. He struggles to try to keep the surface smooth. After World War II, he buys surplus military equipment, strips it for parts, and invents a machine. In 1949, he files a patent for the first Zamboni and included a landing gear from a surplus bomber. Ultimately, he moved his company and production from Southern California to Canada. Incidentally, that factory is now located in Brantford, Ontario, birthplace of Wayne Gretzky. By the way, curling doesn't use Zambonis. Apparently, they want a rough surface. Zamboni news you can use. This is Central Time.